Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is Episode 2, A Legacy of Healing. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. The power of the Freedom Writers story was this tagline of keeping it real. And in keeping it real, we had to be candid and honest, and sometimes go to a place that dealt with controversial subjects. So this episode is heavy, deliberately so, because we are pulling back a curtain. We're shedding light in dark places. And if any of these feelings resonate with you, the most important thing that we want to provide to you is the ability to know that it can and will get better. If you need help, seek it. If you need someone to speak to, find someone who is non-judgmental, who will listen and lead you to a path of health, healing, and resources. Our theme this week is mental health and addiction. We're going to be looking at stories told by people who are survivors, people who have struggled with bipolar disorder, people who've overcome addiction and deep, deep depression. And they're going to be telling their firsthand stories how to come out of the darkness and no longer suffer in silence. First, we'll hear a story from freedom writer Michael Bongiorno about his journey to overcome addiction. The next segment will be our diary of the day, where we'll be bringing you an excerpt from the Freedom Writer's Diary. Finally, our featured discussion is with former Congressman Patrick Kennedy. We'll be talking about his family legacy, his personal struggle with addiction, and his subsequent advocacy for mental health parity. We sincerely thank you for tuning in, and we hope that this particular episode is helpful. Here's Michael.
My name is Michael Bongiorno. I'm operations manager at a treatment center. I have passion and purpose, and I am a freedom rider. I was an overweight, long-haired, fear-stricken child, and I was having a lot of disciplinary issues at my school at a young age. I first took my first sip of alcohol at probably 11 or 12 years old. I was very, very young. I had lost my house where I grew up in into a large fire. It was a mountain fire that came in and destroyed our house. And I didn't really understand what was going on. I was scared. And so I was just kind of in this state of just limbo. Where do I go? And the only thing I had was alcohol to medicate these feelings and to push them down. And so it started escalating from there. At however old I was, 15 years old, you know, drinking a 12-pack of beer a day was the normal for me. That's the only thing I could think about was getting out of school and drinking or leaving school and drinking. I didn't have anybody in my life to say, hey, there's other things you can do too to make you feel good besides drinking. It was very dark and it just kind of turned me into a very, very, very fear-stricken, angry person. And so that had evolved into the person that had stepped into Ms. Gruel's class. Ms. Gruel showed me at that time that writing could really set me free, and it made me feel great. It was taking all my anger and all my fear and letting it pulsate out into brighter things. Ms. Gruel got me through that school. She really did. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have made it. I mean, I was going down a path of bad choices my entire life. But it wasn't until after I had graduated that I realized that I'm gonna do the exact 180 on this. So no alcohol, no cigarette smoke, no unhealthy foods, exercise. And I just got addicted to that stuff. And it wasn't enough. I kept picking up other hobbies. I started speaking and selling and creating and socializing. And I started feeding myself all these things without the negative, and I became a force. Created my own power bar company. I bought steaks in another one, did extremely well, had a great relationship, met a girl that changed my life. And I realized that I have passion and purpose, and I want to embrace that. So 4 years ago, I decided that I'm going to do what I'm really good at, and that's helping people that struggle with addiction. People trusted me because I came from their same point, and now I'm operations manager at a treatment center, and that's changing lives. It's the best of all worlds. I have my passion and purpose at my job where I change lives suffering from addiction. And then I have the Freedom Riders where I can go reach youth and stop them from getting addicted, right? Help them. If we can evoke your passion at a young age, you will lead miracles with that energy, and then clarity will come. Once the clarity comes, you have vision, you have purpose, and you're a leader. You'll be unstoppable.
Michael really is a leader, a true force. And with his passion and his purpose, he's helping people struggling with addiction to find their voice, to become leaders themselves, and be unstoppable. He started out as my student, and now he's my teacher. And he really found a platform, and that is helping teachers understand what their students are going through. So each and every year, we do Freedom Writer Teacher Institutes. And the word teacher, I use air quotes, because you don't have to be a classic teacher in a high school or middle school. You could be a social worker, you could be a counselor, you could be a principal, a school board member, an advocate for change. Imagine listening to and learning from Michael and freedom writers just like him who have learned to be that force. If you would like to learn more about our teacher institutes, feel free to send us an email at fwi@freedomwritersfoundation.org. You too can be a freedom writer teacher. It's time for our Diary of the Day, a segment where Freedom Writers rotate reading anonymous entries from their book, The Freedom Writer's Diary. Today's entry, diary number 58, is a story about deep depression that led to a suicide attempt. It will be read by Mauricio Tony Becerra.
Dear Diary, I have a problem. For the past 2 years, I've been tormented by an illness that runs in my family. When I was 4, my mother was diagnosed as clinically depressed because of a chemical imbalance. Luckily, she sought out help before it was too late. She received medical attention and was cured with the help of a drug treatment called amitriptyline. Now this illness, our family's enemy, has returned to claim yet another victim. Against my will, I have been taken prisoner and feel like I'm being punished for a crime I did not commit. My worst nightmare is now becoming my reality. Suicide is something that's always on my mind 24/7. There isn't a day that goes by without the enemy shooting suicidal thoughts through my mind. I am left injured and confused. Without notice, the enemy takes control of my body and mind, and I become its puppet. The thoughts, as well as my feelings, are recreated into my worst fears. I start crying and screaming for no reason, raging with an unexplained anger stored deep inside of me. Then I am left feeling worthless, without any hope of living. I even tried to take my life once, because I thought there was no other alternative. Now that I think back, it seems so fake, like one of those corny after-school television specials. Not knowing what to do, I ended up in the kitchen. I felt a cold breeze as I entered. There I was, standing in the dark, holding a kitchen knife to my wrist. My heart began to beat faster and faster as I held out my arm. I pulled back my sleeve, exposing my wrist. My mind blacked out. I looked down to see the knife had barely cut into my skin. The knife was too dull.
The story that Tony just read is a story that I use each and every time I do a teacher training because it is powerful. And I know that the young person who wrote that was in a very dark place, but had the courage to put down that knife and ask for help. I was a mandated reporter to help my students find a way to put down that knife, that bottle of pills, or even step back from that ledge. As teachers, parents, caring adults, we're on the front lines of these students' lives. We have to be advocates to help them overcome depression, addiction, or thoughts of suicide. They need us. They need you. Our featured guest today truly embodies the sense of responsibility, a sense of duty to provide hope and healing to anyone who might be struggling with these very real issues. And he's able to do so because he's gone through these struggles himself. I'm humbled to share with you my conversation with my friend, Patrick Kennedy. He's a former congressman, an advocate, and the best-selling author of A Common Struggle, a personal journey through the past and future of mental illness and addiction. Patrick joins us today by phone. It is an honor for me to introduce our guest today, who is an advocate for civil rights, a fierce activist for mental health parity, and has been able to give a platform for people across the globe who have suffered in silence about issues of both addiction and mental health. He's been able to take his name, his legacy, and his political platform to bring this discussion into our homes, into our classrooms, onto stages and our television sets, and to take that stigma and stereotype away. So, Patrick, it is a privilege for us to have a very substantive discussion today about something that is now your life's work. So thank you for agreeing to be part of this podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Aaron, and I'm a big fan of yours and all your freedom writers and the Freedom Writers Diary and all that you've done to try to bring more awareness around issues of inclusion and tolerance and love and compassion. It's a beautiful thing, and I'm honored to be part of this.
Aw, thank you. Patrick, you've been such a special part of our Freedom Writer family for almost 2 decades, and we thank you for always being so transparent and sharing your story with us. So what I'd like to do is I want to start with what it was like for you as a kid. Growing up in Massachusetts with this name, this dynasty, and a father who was a state senator.
You know, being born into the Kennedy family was obviously an accident of birth, and in a real sense, I hit the lottery because I have been given so many experiences just by dint of birth, and I'm so honored to carry this last name that I do. I'm proud of the heritage that it brings. I'm proud that President Kennedy was the first president to address the cause of civil rights as president of the United States, really calling it the moral crisis of his time. I'm so proud of my Uncle Robert Kennedy and all he did to break the fast with Cesar Chavez and stand up for people who were being discriminated against, whether it was the farm workers or others in the organized labor movement. So honored that my aunt Eunice Kennedy Shriver was the founder of the Special Olympics, which is now in over 187 countries around the world and has literally liberated families everywhere in this earth from the shackles of discrimination and shame that came with having a family member who was diagnosed with an intellectual and developmental disability. And of course, this is the anniversary of my Uncle Robert Kennedy's passing and his murder, along with Dr. King. And of course, the two of them were so close in their fight for social justice. And, you know, all of that history is a lot. And my dad, of course, over the years, ensuing years since my uncles were killed, kind of kept their fight going in the United States Senate, becoming one of the most prolific senators of all time in terms of the number of laws on the books that were a direct result of his work and sponsorship. So that's pretty humbling. And certainly growing up, I was very overwhelmed, to say the least, by this legacy.
So for our students who are listening, tell us about your childhood and maybe some of those insecurities you had about being a Kennedy and not always feeling like you were able to rise to the occasion of being the quarterback or student body president. I'd love for kids to know that it does get better.
Well, first, really, there's nothing for me to complain about. I had it made. There's nothing that I have had to endure comes close to what many, many, many people have to try to survive in terms of grinding poverty, incredible violence, you know, a whole host of impacts that I have been blessed not to have to be familiar with in a personal way. My challenges growing up were less imposed by my environment as much as the kind of genetic predisposition that I had to a mental illness. My mother and her mother both suffered very acute and deep mental illnesses. My mother has been disabled most of her life as a result of her very severe depression. My grandmother, her mother, passed away at 61 from alcoholism and was alone and was not found for over a week, because it's the nature of these illnesses that people who suffer from alcoholism and addiction, severe depression, just isolate themselves from everyone around them. And so that kind of genetic part of my family history really found its way into me. And I'm able to look back on it now and understand why I felt the way I did. You know, by all outward circumstances, I should not have felt bad or depressed. You know, very little to be depressed about. Obviously, I wish I had seen my father, but so don't every child. You know, my father worked very hard and was obviously father not only to myself but to all of my cousins who had lost their fathers. And as I said, with my mother being so disabled by depression and alcoholism, you know, obviously I wish I'd had a chance to be connected with her. So in a real sense, it made me appreciate not only the genetic components of my family history, but also the environmental impact of not having that kind of parental consistency that I think is so important to surviving even kind of a genetic predisposition to depression. I think people can survive if they have a loving, supportive adult that is there consistently in your life. It doesn't have to be a biological relative. It can be someone else who takes a great interest in you. I found that has been what the science shows, and it's also been what my experience has shown. I have done the best when I've had that support, and especially since, you know, I struggled to get it while coming from the family that I came from.
I loved meeting your mom. She was so vibrant and loving and honest about her struggles. And what I noticed the reaction with you, which I parallel with my students, is often students who grow up in a household of silence and addiction, is the child ceases being the child and becomes the caretaker and the parent. And I very much notice that with you and your mom. You made decisions for her, around her, about her. So what was that like, having this duality of being a kid, but also being very much a parent?
Well, you know, my brother and sister and I all shared guardianship of our mother. And that is a very difficult process whereby the court gives you jurisdiction of all aspects of a person's life. In this case, the court gave my brother and sister and I basically trusteeship over my mother. So that is true literally. It's not just a figurative statement to say that, you know, it is often the case where you become an adult child and you become the adult in a relationship where your parent has traded places with you in a sense. You know, but I don't think it was anything that was unusual for me, because as I said, it was a normal experience for me growing up that she was constantly fighting the impairment and the disability that came from her alcoholism and depression. And when my brother and sister and I ultimately got guardianship over our mother, strangely enough, it was kind of like just an extension of what we had already kind of taken on emotionally, and that is that we were always kind of looking out for her as opposed to it being the other way around.
I love that you're such a champion for something that often is swept under a rug or tragically vilified. And so I'd like you to talk about the importance of humanizing the suffering and not taking the opportunity to have these sweeping stereotypes that often happen after we've seen the effects of mental illness.
Well, I think we all can think of a family member in our own lives when someone was acting in a way that was so contrary to their own self-interest. My mother constantly was shaming herself by the way her disease kept putting her in embarrassing situations. In other words, if she wasn't held hostage by her alcoholism, there's no way anybody without the disease of addiction would have permitted themselves to be put over and over again in situations where they could be ridiculed. So that's how we need to look at it. If we really think that this is always a matter of choice, and I do think that there is a little bit of choice, but I also believe that it's pretty self-evident that it's not as if someone, when they get up every day, tries to alienate everyone around them, their family, their friends, their employer, if they're lucky enough to have a job. And yet, if you have a mental illness or addiction, you're pretty much doing everything in your power every single day to get fired from a job, to get kicked out of a relationship, to lose touch with all the people that matter most to you, to be in poverty, and most likely to be arrested. I mean, that's not what people set out for themselves every day when they get up. But when you have a mental illness and addiction, those things of jails, institutions, and death are a high risk that you run every single day. And it's not something that anyone chooses. And I think that points to the fact that these are illnesses as opposed to character flaws.
For our listeners, many of whom are young kids, what I'd love for you to do is to paint a picture. You and I have shared some really deep stories, and I have these images of you as a child coming home and seeing your mom at that point incapacitated. And you share that sometimes you didn't want to bring friends over to your home, or you swore to yourself that you were never going to be like her. So as a child, you thought, I'm going to make a choice to make different decisions than my mother. Can you talk about when you realized it wasn't a choice, that some of her demons to grapple with were ultimately your demons and what you were grappling with as well?
Well, as I said, I think these illnesses really do not become apparent until you're able to see in your own life how much you've become affected by them. And that doesn't come easily. To some, it comes very abruptly and suddenly, and they're forever changed. And in a sense, they're blessed because they're able to decide to live a different life that keeps them from being vulnerable to those decisions that could get them back into addiction or active mental illness at any given point. In my case, it wasn't until I left Congress that I had a better appreciation for how I had lived my life up until 43 years of age. I had some vague understanding that I had addiction. I had certainly been to treatment at the age of 17. That should have been enough for most people to understand that this was something that they should be careful of. But rather than that be a wake-up call for me, it just passed me by. And it was nearly a dozen other detoxes and rehabs before I was, you know, finally no longer living in the life that I had known in politics. I was outside of the place that I'd called home for nearly 25 years. I had no staff or quote unquote connections. I was doing the most simple thing in the world that I could do, and that was just to go to 12-step recovery. And it wasn't until that moment that I began to this journey where I understood better that the illness that I had been grappling with for years was the same illness that, you know, my mother had been grappling with her whole life. But it's sometimes impossible to get any perspective when you're in the middle of managing your illness. And some of us can be better at managing to survive than others. And that's a mixed blessing, because you can survive, and that's good, but it also keeps you from appreciating the full depth of your despair and disease.
What our listeners may not know is you were so young when you entered politics. Coming out of rehab when you were 17, you went on to become one of the youngest state assemblymen in Rhode Island, where you went to college, the youngest congressman elected. You and your father were the father and son duo serving on Capitol Hill. So what was that like to be in these fancy rooms, alcohol's being served, constantly to say no, knowing the history of your mother? Did that ever nag at you? Was that ever difficult for you?
You know, in spite of the fact that I had periods of sobriety, I should say dry periods, I never was sober. And by the term sober, I mean, you know, able to be insightful as to what was going on in my life. If I wasn't looking for an escape through alcohol or drugs, I was looking for an escape through the hurly-burly and rush of being in a very chaotic life that felt very comfortable to me, the life of being in politics and in Congress and on Capitol Hill. That was a very distracting life, and that suited me very well because I couldn't pay attention to what was really going on inside of me. And it wasn't until, as I said, I left Congress that I was able to finally let the seas settle a little bit and get into some real recovery, which is not only just the absence of self-medicating, but also the embracing of a set of spiritual principles that give you a sense that there is more to life than just living it based upon impulses alone.
Back in those days, going to rehab was something that people didn't discuss. It wasn't on a campaign flyer. It wasn't something you stumped at a speech. So I'm so glad that you're able to talk about that, that rehab was a part of your journey, but when you failed forward. Can you talk about that, that taking that out of the darkness and making it be a part of your story now, it's something that you don't have to hide, that's not shrouded in secrecy. It's very much who you are.
Well, I definitely wanted to keep it a secret, like almost anybody else who was found out to be suffering from addiction or mental illness. These are not things that you put on your resume. That's just the way it was. And frankly, it's the way it is still for 99% of the public. If you're able to put some years of continuous sobriety in between you and your last drink, drug, then it actually becomes something that you would put on your resume, if you will, that you had that experience and you were able to move past it. My challenge was that I was never able to string together many consecutive days of sobriety. And even though I was able to have periods of sobriety, I always returned to drinking and drugging. So that's what kept me from really being able to say that this was something I was proud of, because it wasn't at all. It was something I was ashamed of, but I can say today it's something I'm proud of, in the sense that I'm proud that in spite of the fact that I am an alcoholic and addict, I am able to live in sobriety in a different way. And I'm able to show the amount of time that I'm able to put together between my last drink and where I am today because I practice the principles of 12-step recovery. We call that lived experience today. Those of us who are able to have some sobriety, we actually are very proud of that history, because it's no longer a definition of who we are. It's a definition of who we are that we've been able to overcome it and become different people.
One of the things I want to share with our listeners is when you addressed the Freedom Writers and our extended Freedom Writer teacher family, immediately following your presentation, one of the Freedom Writers who was suffering in silence from an opioid addiction came to me and wanted to get clean. And until we could find this young man a place to go to rehab, he went through detox on my couch. And you were the first person I reached out to, because I knew that you were the catalyst for him to get clean. You would tell him the importance of sobriety. And I don't know if you realize how much that meant to him spiritually and emotionally, that someone of your caliber was willing to be that momentary sponsor. And I thank you for that.
For those of us who are blessed to be in 12-step recovery, we know that trying to help someone else is the best way we know how in order for ourselves to stay sober, because in focusing on other people's challenges, you automatically forget your own challenges. And that's the best part about service, which is a cornerstone of the 12-step recovery movement.
I want to talk to you about the decision to leave Congress and branch out and be so transparent. Writing a book, an autobiography, can be very scary for some people because you lay it on the page. So talk about your willingness to leave the platform of politics to have a very different platform, which was advocate for mental health parity.
Well, I fell into the role of being the primary sponsor of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, a law that basically said that the brain is part of a body. I got to sponsor that because I had been exposed, if you will, outed by somebody that I had been in drug treatment with, who sold their story to the National Enquirer. The ultimate irony was that even though I was fighting for mental health and addiction for the country, I was having to leave Congress because of my inability to manage my own mental health and addiction while being a congressman. At the end of the day, my own mental health and addictions were beyond my individual ability to control, and I did have control over one situation, and that was whether I was going to get pushed out of Congress because of my mental illness and addiction, or whether I was going to retire and define the terms for myself as to what would happen with me going forward. So that's what I did. I left Congress because I was very, very concerned about my own mental health. And I was fortunate that I not only found a new life where I was able to get better mental health for myself, but I also found a new life in my ability to advocate for the implementation of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, which had been my signature issue while I was in Congress. So when I left, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with myself. I knew I needed to strengthen my own mental health and address my own addictions and start a new way of life outside Washington, D.C., and outside of everything that was familiar to me. I really needed a new beginning. I also felt, in order to kind of bring closure to my life up until that point, I did want to look back. My book, A Common Struggle, is a book about not only my own struggles with mental health and addiction issues, but it was also a book about the experience I had serving in Congress and working on this Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act law that actually required insurance companies to treat these illnesses like any other illnesses. All of that's kind of tied together in my book, A Common Struggle. The common, in essence, struggle is the silence that pervades these issues, the fear and the shame that's associated with these illnesses, and the inability for us to advocate properly for these illnesses because of our worry that people are going to judge us because we have them. That's the common aspect of this struggle, which applies not only to someone like me who comes from this famous family and has had the honor of serving in Congress, but it really applies to every single family that I've met in my journey, all of whom feel that sting of shame and stigma when it comes to people knowing that they are a patient or whether they are a family member of someone who is being treated for mental illness or an addiction.
What advice can you give to that ordinary teacher, that parent who sees her son or daughter come home and shut the door and turn off the lights and crawl into bed, that caring adult, that rabbi, imam, or minister? What can an adult do to help a young person to find help?
We know with mental illnesses and addictions that the longer they go on unchecked, the worse they get. So like any other illness, early intervention, early help makes all the difference. Young people are the ones who are impacted the most by mental illness and addiction. So it's even more important that we are proactive about speaking to them and really finding out how they are doing. Not in any judgmental way, but in the very realistic way that all the professional medical societies say that this is something that just is long overdue as far as what we consider a complete medical checkup. In other words, it's not a checkup for just those who appear to be suffering, but frankly, we need to look at having a checkup from the neck up literally for everybody, because everybody needs to be screened. It's quite remarkable that illnesses of the brain are not treated like illnesses of the body, because they're seen as moral character flaws as opposed to chemistry issues. And ultimately, understanding of the neuroscience tells us that they're not unlike any other set of chronic illnesses. When you think of mental illnesses, depressions, anxieties, addictions, they track like any other chronic set of illnesses. In other words, they need to be in remission, but in order to keep them in remission, you need to take the precautionary steps to be healthy so as to not to fall back into illness. And that's the case with diabetes and what your diet looks like and making sure you don't have too much sugar or you need insulin for the chemistry issues that you have, or any other set of chronic illnesses, asthma, cardiovascular disease. We have both medications and we have therapies for all these other chronic illnesses, and yet we don't have the same for chronic illnesses of the brain. And it just doesn't stand to reason, especially after all that we know about brain illnesses today and how effectively we can treat them if the proper protocols are followed. So in the future, this will be so passe, it'll be so normalized that we won't think about, oh, is it okay? Should I? You know, those questions will be something of the past. We need to be very proactive in sparking those conversations. And if an adult or guardian does not have the tools in their own repertoire to engage a child, there are plenty of resources that will help them learn those tools in short order to help them find the language that they need in order to speak to their child.
In our last few moments, Patrick, I just want to ask you, for a lot of the students I serve, they were not alive to hear the great orators, your uncle JFK as president, fighting for civil rights, or MLK standing on those steps, demanding for us to dare to dream and be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. But what they do get to hear is you. You are an orator. And I love how passionate you are for equality and parity. So if you could be that JFK, or you could be that Martin Luther King Jr. to a student today who's in a dark place, what kind of path do you want to lead them down?
Well, the great thing in Dr. King's message and in Robert Kennedy's message and so many others that inspired generations, the essential element was that there was something that each of us could do as individuals, that we didn't need to solve all the world's problems or be written about in the history books or be celebrated on the evening news, that it was the difference that we made in one person's life that we were able to touch because we had a gift that we could give them, whether that was love, that was listening, that was the compassion of our time, the energy that we could bring to assist them and helping them with whatever they were faced with. That is what makes greatness. And in the process of all that, people can be inspired. It's an example that others notice. There's nothing more powerful than action. It's really not in the oratory. It's in the action. What was so inspiring about Dr. King was that he put his life on the line over and over and over again. And he was present in the moment and available to people that surrounded him. What was inspiring by Robert Kennedy was not necessarily the words he said, but the way that he carried his fight for social justice in a way that was filled with integrity, that was devoid of some punchline or great rhetorical flourish that seemed empty when compared to what his record was. So I don't think there's anything that I can say that would inspire a young person today. What I could say to them is, see how they feel when they do something nice for someone else without any regard for the reward, and they'll find their own inspiration through that process. Wow. You know, I believe in the spiritual aspect of service, where we elevate our own lives and become something different and something greater than who we are as individuals when we are part of a greater mission to improve the well-being and the suffering of others. And I think our country needs to feel that there is another side of the coin outside of the fear and cynicism and apathy, that there is a side of vibrancy and engagement and compassion and love. And that side is fired by the spiritual dimension. And the spiritual dimension is what I would encourage those who are young to seek out. And it's not a religious journey. It's really a journey that connects people to something that's greater than themselves. If they can never get above their own individual wants or desires, then they can never transcend the immediacy of their problems and become the kind of leaders that they want to become. I think the words of Dr. King, we're all caught in an inescapable web of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. What affects one directly affects all indirectly. We're all in this together.
In honor of their truth, may we all have a legacy of healing. This concludes our show this week, a very candid discussion. For those of you that need more, we encourage you to go to our show notes and check out the Parity Registry created by Patrick Kennedy and his colleagues. And we hope that you reach out to anyone and everyone that can help you. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier with production assistance from Clay Amator. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share the hope, and help us pass on this message of freedom. Our call to action today is this. May we be kind and compassionate. May we help instead of judge. And may we remember, as our dear guest Patrick Kennedy quoted, whatever affects one directly affects us all indirectly. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.